Welcome to this podcast from Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. This podcast is made possible through support from the members of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about events or membership, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum or join us on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I'm Lindsay Rydell, a reporter with the San Francisco Business Times. Tonight we consider nuclear energy fueling the future. The United States is in the midst of an energy crisis, and myriad solutions have been proposed to solve it. One of the more controversial proposals is expanding nuclear power production nationwide. Critics of the plan say it's unsafe, costly, and ineffective, while proponents argue that it's a fast and simple way to boost carbon-neutral energy production. Tonight, our guests will evaluate and debate these claims and what the real truth is about nuclear power. Tonight, we host Angie Howard, Senior Vice President of the Nuclear Energy Institute, Jeffrey Rothwell, an economist at Stanford University who has been chief economist at the United States Department of Energy, and Ralph Kavanaugh, senior attorney and co-director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's Energy Program. Please welcome our panel. So I'm just going to kick off the questions, and maybe I'll direct this one first at Angie. How is the debate on nuclear energy changing today?
Well, the debate on nuclear energy is changing because the public has really realized that we have a problem of global warming or climate change. And nuclear energy represents 70% of our non-emitting sources of generation. And so as we've thought about the use of nuclear energy as a way of addressing climate change, both Republicans and Democrats across the country are asking, why don't we look at additional nuclear as one part of the solution? That and energy security is another.
Okay, and Ralph, I'd like you to answer that same question.
Well, a couple of interesting things haven't changed. The last time anyone ordered a nuclear plant and built it in the United States was 1973. And as all of your presence signifies, this was conceived when I started 30 years ago and is still conceived as in part and in very significant part, a public choice in which public views matter and which public forums matter. Those are rock-hard constants. I agree with Angie that one thing that has changed is that the context is in part one of global warming and climate change. In addition, I think, and this is a very positive development we should all celebrate, the array of alternatives that's competing with nuclear for investment in a capital-constrained world is vastly richer than it was 30 years ago. There are many more intriguing opportunities for energy efficiency, for renewables, for a host of other options, and nuclear is going to have to fight it out in an increasingly competitive and formidable arena.
Very nice. And Jeff, what else can you say about how the debate is changing and what's driving those changes?
Well, I think there's been more of a shift in the last few years towards the question of nonproliferation and what this increase or this renaissance in nuclear power means for proliferation issues. I don't remember that being such a central part of the debate 20 years ago. But the nuclear power industry is now a global industry. We sold off our mines, our uranium mines, so we do not own our own uranium mines now. Our enrichment facilities are antiquated, and the French are building new facilities for us to enrich our uranium so we can use it as nuclear fuel. But so we're now a part of a global economy, and we can make policy decisions, but we are now beholden to the global nuclear power industry to provide these services and products, and so we can't just do what we want to anymore.
So let's talk about carbon footprint. How does nuclear energy's carbon footprint compare to other sources of power, and do we need to look at nuclear power to reduce that carbon footprint overall of energy production? Start with you again, Angie.
Well, clearly, from the standpoint of non-emitting sources of power generation. Nuclear is one, as are renewables. If you look at the total life cycle cost, is what you would also look at as well, is that while you do have some fossil energy used in the production of nuclear fuel, overall, the life cycle cost of a nuclear energy facility is one of the lowest of our various choices in generating energy. So that's a very important aspect that nuclear has and can provide going forward as a lower carbon footprint.
On the question whether we have to have nuclear to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, global warming pollution. First of all, I appreciate Angie's noting that there are a host of interesting competitors. The biggest and most interesting single competitor is one she didn't mention, which I refer to as an energy efficiency resource, which is, of course, all of the myriad ways of getting more work out of less energy. That's, the fastest, cheapest, and cleanest option we've got. When you listen to this debate, you'll often hear people say, we need to do everything to get where we need to in global warming pollution or energy security or any of this is, for better or worse, the obsessive topic of the day. And the commonest response seems to be, we've got to do everything. My response is, you know something? We can't afford to do everything. And the people who are going to make the decisions about the nuclear plants, remember, it's not going to be the federal government. The federal government has no money and essentially no role in choosing power generation technology. Decisions are going to be made by electric utilities on budgets, running competitive resource procurements in which energy efficiency goes head-to-head against renewables, fossil, and nuclear. If, as I hope, and I think as Angie hopes, and this will be an interesting point, I suspect, of agreement between us, if the Congress moves to adopt mandatory limits on global warming pollution, as California already has, we're going to have a competition to see what resources can reduce carbon at the lowest cost, and I'm looking forward to it.
So without factoring in the potential cap and trade or carbon credits, does nuclear compare cost-wise? Does it make sense to build it right now?
Well, I'm the economist.
Yeah, but you have $8 billion.
That's the problem. You're going to hear lots of numbers out there in the press about the cost of nuclear power. There's the cost of construction, and sometimes there'll be a confusion between overnight costs, how much it would cost without paying for the financing, or the cost of power with financing, life cycle costs, the cost of fuel, all these sorts of things. So you're going to see out there being reported from lots of different utilities, lots of different numbers. And so you're going to start thinking, well, what's the number? Okay, I'm just going to tell you. Okay, just start right now. It's $5,000 overnight, okay, per kilowatt.
Now, compared to?
Let's say compared to coal, which would be about $2,500 per kilowatt. But once you build the nuclear power plant, there's very little uncertainty in the fuel and the operations. There's very little uncertainty. Whereas when you've built the coal plant for half the cost, there's you never know what's going to happen right now with the price of coal. You don't know what's going to happen with the cost of carbon in the coal. And so there's a lot of uncertainty up front with nuclear power, but once it's built and you've paid the $5 to $8 billion for the power plant, you've got something that's going to be running and producing for 60 years. So it's mighty expensive up front right now, but once you build it, there's very little risk, very little cost associated with running the plant.
And just that, so what you're saying is, are you comfortable saying that over time nuclear gets less expensive and potentially less expensive than coal?
No, it depends on the cost of capital and the riskiness of the project. But, you know, for right now, it's very expensive. And so the U.S. government is encouraging the first 6 to 10 nuclear units with different types of subsidies, loan guarantees being the most with the most strength in terms of promoting the building of a nuclear power plant. So I think that's more than 2 or 3 minutes. But
Angie, do you think that? How do you think that costs compare? And also, do you think when you look at the cost, you factor in the cost of disposing of that nuclear waste and what might happen to that nuclear waste once you dispose of it years down the road.
Jeff's correct, and there are a lot of numbers, but nuclear is very capital intensive. But you're building big baseload units. Remember, we need to have power that operates San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York 24/7. And so we have on our electric system baseload generation, which is nuclear and also coal. And then you have the intermittent sources, such as that renewables can play a part, a hydroelectric, that can get you over the peak. But you really do need some of that big baseload. And you're right, nuclear is capital intensive. We won't build a lot of nuclear if it's not competitive with alternatives. And today that comparison is natural gas, and there's a lot of volatility. Natural gas is cheap to build, but a lot of volatility in the price of gas. We've seen it skyrocket over the last few weeks and months. We've seen coal, the uncertainty there is the cost of carbon constraints. And will we be able to capture the carbon and sequester the carbon? In our nuclear facilities, you do include your cost of decommissioning and the cost of waste storage.
Storage for non-disposal. Go ahead, Ralph.
Well, I think part of the problem here, Jeff is a great Stanford economist, and I yield to no one in my admiration for the institution, but he doesn't have $8 billion. And the people who do, and there are a relative handful of them in the economy, they're all big utilities, the choices they have to make, it's not just the issue of how much the plant costs. There's also the problem of the scale of the plant. The economy-sized Mitsubishi reactor, a 1,600-megawatt machine, is the scale of the annual consumption of the city of Seattle. And if you're building something that big, the enduring memory of the Three Mile Island nuclear plant as a financial risk matter, as one regulator put it at the time, there are very few other technologies where a $1 billion asset can be converted into a $2 billion liability in half an hour by an inexperienced operator. The scale of the technology is a real problem. A dinosaur in a world of small mammals. And if you are, even if you're PG&E, you may have $8 billion, but you want to spend it carefully. You're going to look at all of your options for providing that 24/7 power that Angie mentioned, and also for meeting the needs of the system as they change from day to day and month to month. And you've got a gloriously dizzying array of options for doing it, most of which are far smaller in scale, take much less time to build, and some of them, the energy efficiency options, which share nuclear's carbon profile and beat it, but don't even require you to make the kind of capital commitment and generation that delivers those financial risks. It is noteworthy that PG&E's, our hometown utility here, their highest priority resource isn't coal, it isn't nuclear, it isn't any of the renewables or the gas generation, which have rightly been criticized in the past few minutes. It's energy efficiency. Many of you know that. Many of you are helping by taking advantage of the investments that the company's making. My one firm prediction is that energy efficiency will be the top priority resource for the entire utility industry over the next decade, and everything else will be competing for what's left.
Is that something that you agree with? Or?
I would agree with that. There's no question. And I'm at a meeting in San Francisco now with the electricity industry, and there's a tremendous steps that are being taken in energy efficiency. We've got to have energy efficiency. We've got to lower that demand. There's no question about that because new power generation is expensive. Energy efficiency is not cheap, but we've got to do that, and we've got to develop our renewable resources as well. And, you know, Ralph can say, you know, somebody will tell you we have to have it all. Those are the choices that will be made in the marketplace. But we are positioning nuclear energy to be one of those choices going forward. And over time, that 24-hour-a-day, 7 days a week, baseload power over 60 years can generate a lot of safe, reliable, non-emitting electricity.
But why can't we just do that with, say, solar thermal or some of the other big, large alternative energy-type resources that we're investing so much money in today? Can that handle the base load? And if we really ramped up scale and put $8 billion into solar thermal, let's say, or biofuels, then could that handle the energy demand?
We're going to find out. That is, right now, the way California handles electric resource procurement is that it's a competition. PG&E, Southern California Edison, San Diego Gas and Electric, the city of Palo Alto are constantly in the marketplace, and they're testing the market to answer exactly the question you just posed. What Angie and I are really doing is giving you both different predictions as to how that competition is going to come out. The good news for many in this audience is neither of us gets to choose. The people who will choose are going to be people who are responsible both to shareholders and to the public through the regulatory process that has to approve those long-term investments and approve the cost recovery required to allow them to go forward.
Now, a lot of these renewable resources are very good for non-distributed sources. Like, you see these telephone things on the highway? Those are solar. Your cell phones are powered with cells that are solar. Out in the middle of nowhere, solar, wind, whatever. These are technologies that are very good for countries that do not have very well-developed distribution systems. You wouldn't want to build a nuclear power plant in a country that only uses as much power as that nuclear power plant would provide. You have to have about 10 times the capacity to be able to provide electricity when that nuclear power plant is shut down and being refueled. So you've got to have a very big system to start with. So many of these renewables are competitive right now out in the middle of nowhere where you don't have to build a very expensive transmission line in. So they're being developed and so forth. So, you know, one question we haven't really talked about is the cost of disposing of CO2 and whether or not that is actually going to happen. How many of you guys have CO2 every day? Almost everybody has CO2. Okay, now, does anybody want to live next to a CO2 hole in the ground that when it leaks sort of displaces the oxygen in the air and smothers you? How many people would like to have a CO2 tank in their backyard? Anybody?
So bring that back around to the nuclear
okay,
debate.
Okay, so roughly. Now we have this question about the cost of waste disposal being incorporated into coal or natural gas or nuclear power. We don't really know what those costs are. We don't know how much it's going to cost to sequester CO2, and I don't believe it's ever going to happen. Just a coal plant produces 10 million tons of CO2 per year, and it's really hard to hold on to. You've got to have nuclear power produces 3,000 tons of high-level waste per year, and it just sits there. Okay? You don't want to do anything with it. Okay, but we don't know how much it's actually going to cost. We don't know how much it's going to cost to sequester carbon. These are all
so,
unknowns.
So how do we, you know, everybody, when we're talking about this debate, it's we know how we're going to dispose of the waste, and then it's just going to sit there for a long time. Aren't there some kind of environmental effects for just putting the waste in a bunch of tanks and storing it somewhere in a mountain? Aren't we going to have to address that someday?
Well, we are addressing that, Lindsay. And the nuclear waste, you know, you say put it in a bunch of tanks. We're talking about a ceramic pellets. Used fuel is a ceramic material. It's not soluble in water. It's in and is safely stored at the nuclear plant sites today. The industry has an integrated fuel management system where we are safely storing the material today. It's a very small footprint. If you take all of the nuclear waste that we've generated commercially in this country since we started generating electricity with nuclear energy, you could put it on a football field, and it would pile up to the height of the stanchions. It's not a large volume, but it's radioactive, and it must be managed. We can monitor it to extremely low levels. We are developing at the Yucca Mountain site in Nevada a repository to store used fuel, this material. However, since we started developing that project, the conditions in the use of nuclear energy, not only in our country but around the world, have changed. And we are really thinking about relooking at what we could do to recycle that material, because roughly 90% could be recycled. We have to do it in a way that would not generate plutonium as a free source because of the proliferation concerns of plutonium. But we think it's worth safely managing the material today and doing the long-term R&D, 30 to 5, maybe 50 years of R&D to see if we can develop the separation technologies and the fuel and the new types of reactors that we could use that material safely and greatly reduce the volume and the radiotoxicity of the ultimate waste product.
Ralph, how much of a problem do you think the waste is?
Well, here is the difficulty. 24 years ago, the Congress of the United States got together and almost unanimously concluded that the right place to put the nation's high-level nuclear waste was the state of Nevada. Only two senators dissented from that conclusion. The difficulty over the ensuing and the sobering difficulty over the ensuing 24 years is, of course, Yucca Mountain simply has, and I think Angie would acknowledge this, it has not moved forward because the state of Nevada is dug in firmly against it. Not, by the way, normally a hotbed of environmental extremism, but clearly this is, for better or worse, a form of commerce no one in the United States seems to want. If you therefore build a reactor now without a political solution on high-level waste, you have to face the real likelihood that you will be the repository of that waste indefinitely. Now, Angie wants to move to a system that, she says, recycles the fuel. And here, let's be clear on the part of the difficulty, and I was glad to hear her say she wants to try to do it in a way that doesn't put plutonium into international commerce, because, of course, that, in terms of the potential consequences for nuclear proliferation, is something none of us wants to see. It does underscore a point that having civilian nuclear technology for any country outside the United States makes a darn good cover for nuclear weapons development. And just one, all of us would feel a lot better if Iran did not have a vigorous civilian nuclear industry. I am very skeptical that recycling – the one thing I know for sure is that recycling nuclear fuel in any form – and we haven't done it in this country for decades because we've been concerned about proliferation – but doing it in any form is going to raise the cost of nuclear significantly higher. There's only one commercial recycling plant really in the world at the moment operating in France at costs and reliability significantly low, below the standard that the rest of the industry has set. This doesn't look to me like a plausible way forward either. And so I think the unanswered question about what we're going to do with high-level waste is as relevant now. You asked what's changed, Lindsay. It's as relevant now as it was in 1976 when California decided we're not going to site any more nuclear reactors in California until somebody shows us where the waste is going to go. People would have laughed at us 32 years ago, if we'd said we'd be reassembling in 2008 and we still didn't know where it was going to go, but that's where we are.
Mm-hmm. Well.
Do you know where it's going to go?
I don't really care. It's not a big problem. Okay? It's not. Let's think about.
You asked me if I wanted to live next to a CO2 hole.
I grew up in Richland, Washington, next to Hanford, which has got 149 tanks of radioactive waste
leaking
into the Columbia River. And look at me. I'm normal.
He is. For that radio audience, he is.
But this whole question, we have focused on this waste question like it's like, you know, we're just so tied up in this waste. Now we have to prove at Yucca Mountain that there is not going to be a significant leak for 1 million years. Okay, now, I don't know your feeling about the origin of our species. As far as I'm concerned, it's 150,000 years old. Okay, that means we are storing waste so that two species from now, those guys, will be able to farm in this valley outside of Yucca Mountain. Two species from now. Now, the Neanderthals, did we, give them a break? Do you think those species are going to give us a break? But we have to make sure that nothing's going to happen at Yucca Mountain for 1 million years.
Is that possible? Is it feasible to think that
it's
we can ensure?
I can't think of this that stuff just sits there. It doesn't go anyplace. And all you have to do to change the waste policy in the United States is de-link
Yucca Mountain, and an interim storage facility. There's one line in the amendments to the Waste Policy Act that links those two when they went down from three sites to one site. There used to be three sites they were considering instead of just Yucca Mountain. But when they went down to one site, they wanted to make sure that that site got developed. So they linked having an interim storage facility, which is collecting all of the waste from the various power plants into one place instead of having it in 40 different places.
Hey, Jeff, what if Nevada never agrees?
Then we just write them out. You can just write it out. We can have an interim storage facility, and we can locate that in Illinois.
In Arkansas. There is still that. There is always the final problem of where it will go, Jeff. And the fact is, whether you call it interim or permanent, is anyone volunteering to do it at the moment?
Right. But well, let's compare it to 10 million tons of CO2 from one carbon coal plant.
Well, and let me point out, too, just, and maybe we want to go on to some other questions. The Department of Energy has filed a license application for the Yucca Mountain Repository with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It will go into a licensing process and, again, go through a thorough scientific review. Whether it's licensed or not, I don't know. I do think that from a long-term standpoint, it's good to continue to safely manage this material. There are some sites within this country that are interested in interim storage, and we're pursuing that. And we're going to pursue the long-term R&D as a way to reduce the volume of this material and be able to extract material out if we need that in the distant future. And I think we will, again, safely manage this material either on a, as Jeff is saying, on an interim basis, or we do ultimately have a final repository.
Thanks. Let's talk about safety. I think a lot of us are, what we know about nuclear has been informed by major nuclear accidents like Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. So how safe is nuclear energy, and how much safer has it gotten, if it's gotten safer at all, since those accidents have happened?
Well, we have 104 units operating today in this country. Many of them have been operating for nearly 40 years. They do operate safely, and they operate reliably, a capacity factor of over 90%, generating a lot of electricity. They're regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They're on-site resident inspectors. The industry has its own self-policing and self-regulating through the Institute of Nuclear Power Operation. The operators are trained through accredited training programs. There's been much work and much improvements in the safety of the operation since the accident at Three Mile Island, which I might add did not have off-site consequences.
And I probably should let Jeff sum up between us. What I would say about this is that the one thing I'd caution, and I don't think Angie is doing this, to be fair, you never want to be complacent. The nuclear industry urgently needs and has, I think to its credit, tried to maintain a strenuous safety culture. I have not always been able to say the same thing about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and I think more needs to be done there. The Harvard-MIT study of nuclear, which Jeff referred to, established as one of its objectives significant continuing increases in the operational safety of nuclear plants. And I want to echo that, even as I acknowledge Angie, I think, is correct, that the operational record of the industry over the past two decades, you really have to say, has been quite good. And the reliability of the industry in terms of the capacity factor of the power plants has gotten steadily better, as she notes. The problem, I think, with safety is international. Not every country has our safety culture or our safety standards. And as you move to proliferate nuclear reactors, right now we've got 100 reactors out of about 440 internationally. If you move lots more reactors into places that are now proposing to build them, like Algeria, Belarus, Iran, obviously, indeed, several dozen countries that don't have them now want to build them, and there are several countries that are aggressively marketing them, you begin to realize that in some sense the industry's safety record is hostage to the weakest participants, and those participants are not in the United States. And that, I think, is a concern for all of us.
Hey, you've said everything.
Well, that to me is one of the reasons that the United States must maintain a strong and healthy, robust safety of the nuclear plants that we have in this country. We've got to take a leadership role in order to ensure that nuclear, as it's developed around the world, and it will be developed around the world, is going to be done with the right safety culture, with the right equipment, with the right designs. and the right training of the operators. There's a World Association of Nuclear Operators that is doing just as much as the Institute of Nuclear Power Operators is doing in this country by sharing information, recording the lessons learned, looking at events, and sharing that information on a worldwide basis. And we've got to maintain a leadership role to ensure that that continues.
What's your sense of public perception on nuclear, and how important is what the public knows, right or wrong, about nuclear in this debate and getting actually being able to increase the use of nuclear?
We see the public acceptance of nuclear energy in the neighborhood of 60 to 65%. When you ask the question, would you favor the continued use of nuclear energy to generate electricity? We also poll around nuclear power plants, and there the favorability is over 80%. And the reason that is, it's because people live in the community, they know the people who work there, and hopefully the utility is as open and transparent as it can be with the community, and they can understand it. And that's what we have to have, is a very clear and transparent industry.
Go ahead.
I take a slight, obviously, if I'm asked how I feel about the continued contribution of nuclear energy, which produces 20% of U.S. electricity, I would not willingly give it up tomorrow. The consequences would be substantial. On the issue of the construction of new nuclear plants, the general public obviously has been in different places. There are still very substantial, in some polls majorities and some pluralities, who do not want to see more plants developed. But what this really, it's not a popularity contest in the final analysis. It is a straightforward competition. If it were a popularity contest, by the way, I think Angie would acknowledge that solar, renewables, and energy efficiency are at the top of everybody's list. Mm-hmm. But what this is going to come down to is your capacity to convince a utility with scarce capital resources that you're the best buy available in the market. And that's where I think, in the end, nuclear founders.
Jeff, public perception?
Well, you know, you can ask these questions of public opinion in various ways to get various answers. And the reason why a lot of people like nuclear power that are living around it is because nuclear power pays a lot of local taxes. San Luis Obispo County cannot exist anymore without Diablo Canyon. They are totally dependent now on Diablo Canyon, and everybody in San Luis Obispo County loves Diablo Canyon because, you know, everything's free, basically. So, you know, I mean, that's one reason they say yes, because, you know, but, you know, these places are really clean and safe and so forth. So it's not... It's not living next to one that's a problem. It's not the safety of one. It's the bucks. And the bucks stopped. And so, you know, we could take up a collection. And I know that I on my credit cards, I can't get $8 billion, but I can get about $1 million. So, yeah. So if we could get, you know, 80,000 people together to put up $1 million apiece, I think
yeah, and I'm looking out at the audience, and I think I'm relatively safe on this one. But, guys, what utility executives remember very well is they remember the pitchfork era of the late 70s and early 80s when there were more than 100 nuclear plant cancellations costing more than $10 billion to shareholders, the largest municipal bond default in history. People don't forget those things. And that is, I think, if one thought about the likely dangers in terms of public opinion in an era of $4 gasoline and huge public concerns about the cost of energy, I think Jeff is probably right that that belongs at the head of the list.
What about terrorism? How does that change the debate, and how do you address it, and could it be a deal breaker in the end?
Well, the nuclear industry, the commercial nuclear industry, has had a pretty robust security regime at the nuclear plants for many, many years. Obviously, after the attacks on our country of September 11th, 2001, we have greatly enhanced the security at our nuclear facilities. We've done that with people and with buildings, additional buildings and barriers and surveillance. The containment buildings in a nuclear plant are extremely robust. and analyzed for aircraft caches. The rebar is as thick as my forearm. And the concrete, the 3 to 4 foot of concrete and steel liners. And so they're extraordinarily robust. And so we're confident from the safety and security from a terrorist kind of standpoint. What we have to do is ensure this country that we aren't attacked from other reasons and look at our total infrastructure. Nuclear power plants are not very attractive targets.
But there's a lot of low-level waste hanging out. And I'm not going to worry about a terrorist and a nuclear bomb until they do a dirty bomb. And then I'm going to worry a lot. But they haven't used a dirty bomb yet. So just wait until a lot of cesium gets blown up, you know, in London or, you know, New York or something like that. And we've got a terrorist attack. Terror. When you say terrorism, what they're trying to do is not just destroy things. They're trying to terrorize us. And so spreading isotopes that you can steal from a hospital and blowing them up with regular chemicals, that's a problem. And we don't have we don't take care of our isotopes as well as we should. There are isotopes out there that might have been created at a nuclear facility and that are radioactive, but we aren't doing anything to say, well, okay, you know, Children's Hospital has this much of this, and, you know, we don't take care of that stuff.
So what needs to happen in terms of tighter regulation and tighter oversight of nuclear power that's not happening now?
And there, I think Jeff has this right. The principal problem is not the reactors. It's the commerce in fuel, and it is the potential for the civilian reactor operations to either be a cover for clandestine development of weapons or for the kind of development of a dirty bomb that Jeff is worried about. The short answer is that the United States needs to do everything that it can to reinforce and strengthen the enforcement safeguards under the International Treaty on Nonproliferation. And I think all of us agree on that. It's a formidable task. The United States has not been noteworthy in recent years for its support of international institutions. Or for its creation of enforcement resources for them. This is among the most important you can imagine. And an urgent priority of the next administration, I think, will be strengthening those safeguards, the resources going into that agency, and the U.S. contribution to trying to reduce the risk that weapons-grade material will be diverted well before it gets to a nuclear plant into somebody's dirty bomb.
And, you know, that treaty, the Nonproliferation Treaty, has an article in there that says we're supposed to actually be getting rid of our nuclear weapons. And we kind of slowed down on that during the last, say, 8 years. I don't think we've gotten rid of any of them. And so we need to have some kind of a push for disarmament. We don't need 10,000 active warheads and 10,000 in bunkers. Okay? We can get down to 1,000, for example, and this is something that Kissinger and Shultz and Nunn and Perry are working on, trying to get us back on the disarmament road. I think it's a quid pro quo for the Renaissance nuclear power taking off, is getting rid of some of these weapons.
Jeff, I couldn't agree with you more. And do you realize today in this country that 20% of our electricity comes from nuclear? 10% of our electricity in this country comes from downblended Russian warheads. We have an agreement with Russia and the United States to downblend the highly enriched uranium, either from warheads or the highly enriched uranium that hadn't been put into a warhead, and take the enrichment down to power plant level enrichment. And that is what roughly half of our electricity from nuclear energy in this country today is coming from.
So we can transport weapons from Russia to
we
decommission here?
We some of it,
but we can't get the stuff to Yucca Mountain?
Yes.
Is that right?
Hard to believe, isn't it?
It is.
Easier to deal with the Russians than the Nevadans.
It's a good, though.
There is a tension here that I think we can't smooth over entirely, which is that one of the prices of a nuclear renaissance, if we indeed have one, and you, I will mark myself down as a continued and profound skeptic on this, but if we really do have one, and if we're getting the civilian industries into a host of new countries around the world, then commerce in material that can be diverted for terrorist or weapons purposes inevitably increases. Angie says it's inevitable that everyone will develop nuclear power. The reason I emphatically don't feel that way is, again, I think that the perils of nuclear power today and the poor prospects as I see them is a good news story. It's a good news story because there are so many better alternatives from my perspective. And if we put as much effort into helping other countries take advantage of those alternatives as we do in hyping a nuclear renaissance, I think we'll all be safer. And I think the world will have a much more affordable and reliable electrical system.
What can we learn from other countries, what they're doing right in terms of nuclear power? Maybe let's look at France first.
Go ahead, Amy.
France, everything is boom, monolithic. Basically, these guys, they go to the same school, they sleep with the same women, and they make all these decisions, you know, basically from the top down. And it is not really what you call a free market, but it works. Okay, they have the whole cycle. They make things that work. You know, in France, you've got to be in the program. Okay, here, you know, we don't. We have little bits and pieces, and now the French are building nuclear power facilities in the United States. In Russia, again, it was fragmented after the fragmentation of the Soviet Union. Now it's being reconsolidated into Rosatom, and they're going to be a formidable competitor, particularly in uranium enrichment.
I'm going to ask you to pause for 1 second. We're going to be taking questions from the audience in 5 minutes, so if you want to start lining up at the microphones, this would be a good time to do that.
Let me just some of the things that we can learn from each other and learn from overseas. What Jeff is saying is that the French have had standardized reactors. And as we're going forward with looking and planning for new reactors in this country, we too will look for a standardized design. And while there are several designs that are under consideration and under design certification already in this country, and the utilities that are looking at, there is a commitment for standardization. We also are learning, and will learn even more, from the units that are being constructed around the world in new construction techniques, some modularization of construction that will make construction, we think, the quality control better to maintain and also a less expensive way of constructing these new units. And so there's a lot of exchange going on between those countries that have an active program under construction and where we can learn from that.
And all I want to say about this is the centers of the nuclear renaissance are France and China. And I am often in forums in which people say to me, why can't we be more like France and China? And these are people who would not invoke France and China for any other economic proposition imaginable. And so I think Jeff got it right. The countries that have centrally designed and directed electricity programs, where the central government makes the decisions, are, for better or worse, the center of the nuclear renaissance. We don't do it that way. We have competitive procurement. We make everybody compete against each other in open processes with public oversight. I think that's a better way to do it.
So let me ask you really quickly. In 2050, what do you imagine America's use of nuclear energy will look like? Realistically.
Oh, 2050?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Angie, I suspect many of the existing plants will keep extending their licenses,
yes.
And which they seem to have a remarkable proclivity to do. I will be very surprised if there are more than, let's call it, half a dozen new reactors. I expect an orderly phase down of the industry as better, cheaper, more reliable alternatives win the competitive process. And this is, if I am right about this, guys, this is a good news story again. It's about nuclear power being displaced by something better within the constraints of steadily reducing emissions of global warming, pollution, carbon dioxide, other greenhouse gases. That's the future I hope for.
Angie, what about you?
Well, I think we will continue to extend the lives of the existing reactors because they operate safely today, and we're going to ensure that they will be able to continue to meet the regulations. But I also think that we will see additional units that will be built here in this country as well as around the world. And I would expect that there would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 25% to 35% of our electricity will be coming from non-emitting nuclear energy.
So how many new plants would that be?
That would be in the neighborhood of around 40 between now and 2050.
And Jeff?
I'm just trying to work out, you know, who I can make bets with.
And whose credit cards are as forgiving as yours?
In 2050, I think we're just going to have probably just as much nuclear power as we have now, which means
as a percentage or total?
Total. There'll be 100 plants, and some of them will be renewed, some of them will be different, but it'll be about 100 plants. Now, after 2050, there might be a renaissance, but for right now,
that's what you can foresee.
2050 sounds like a long ways away, you know, but it's you know, back 1960, God, it doesn't seem 50 years ago, does it?
Maybe not to some of us. As a reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's Inform program. Tonight we're discussing nuclear energy fueling the future. I'm Lindsay Rydell, and I'm with Angie Howard of the Nuclear Energy Institute, Jeffrey Rothwell of Stanford University, and Ralph Kavanaugh of the Natural Resources Defense Council. We're now going to go to audience questions, and we'll start with this man over here.
Thank you. I hear the number a million years. It sounds like a very scary number, but I've read in the literature and seen graphs where the high-level nuclear waste in 1,000 years is down below the level of the original ore that's mined in places where it was so prevalent that the Indians used to use it as glazes on their pottery till we told them it wasn't a good idea. They liked the nice ochre colors. And so I think that's really where our responsibility is to take the nuclear fuel and wait it out, protect it until it's down to the level of the ore. We don't have to do better than that in terms of protecting the earth, I don't think. Thank you.
Yeah. We'll go to this man over here.
No, it isn't.
Oh, not on. You know what? Let's wait, and we'll get that on, and we'll take a question from over here. Yep.
Thank you. About 30 years ago, a patient of mine mentioned to me the thought of nuclear fusion, all the problems we're having with nuclear energy and the waste is because of nuclear fission. And whatever happened to that concept? Is that a viable alternative?
There is continued worldwide research underway in nuclear fusion, and it continues to be in the research realm, not yet really being energy economic.
Yeah, they're building a $10 billion fusion plant right now on the French-Swiss border, and I always say it's always 20 years from now. Fusion is always 20 years. In the future.
Yeah, in my case, it was always 30, and
okay,
it still is.
30,
right.
40, 50.
Thanks for the question. We're going to go to you over here in the tent.
Okay, I have a question, and it relates to the economics. $8 billion, investors, utilities are going to make a big bet, but there's an administrative hurdle, fairly huge hurdle, and maybe Angie can address this. That the NRC requires two stop licensing, one for a construction license and another one for an operating license, and you have no guarantee of getting an operating license after you've invested $8 billion in construction. Where is that administrative process? Is that going to change?
That licensing process has changed.
It has.
It now, there's a three-pronged process. One where plants can get an early site permit, and some have done that and can bank the sites. There's another one where the NRC will certify the reactor design, and there's some designs that have been certified and others are in the process. And then the third step is going in and filing for a combined construction and operating license. And there are now a number of utilities that have filed those applications with the NRC. And in that case, you are going in with a fully designed facility and going through extensive licensing process. You also are going in with an inspection and acceptance criteria that has been approved by the NRC and defined so that you know exactly what you must do in construction. So you go through a full public hearing with a fully designed plant and get all of those questions aired at that time. And if you receive a combined construction and operating license, you proceed for construction, and then you must demonstrate that you've met the inspection and acceptance criteria to the NRC. And then at that stage, the only way there would be an additional hearing is if someone could come in and be able to prove that you haven't built it according to the design.
And which so occasionally happens.
Which is a well, there. That's why you've got to make sure that you do it correctly and that you follow those inspection and acceptance criteria tooth and nail. We've got to do it and not lose the quality of the construction. And you've got to be able to demonstrate that in a systematic basis as you're going through construction. And so it'll be you won't be at the stage where you are ready to go into operation and held up for months or years in a licensing case.
And while we haven't exercise this process completely yet, and even though we haven't been building nuclear power plants, our regulatory process is basically the model for the world. And so this reactor design certificate is basically becoming a de facto international design approval. Because no other country wants to go through the same process. So there's a lot of other countries waiting for the NRC to approve of, for example, the European pressurized water reactor. So a place like Chile, for example, doesn't want to create a nuclear regulatory commission to approve the design of a reactor. Mm-hmm. And so the NRC, whatever the problems we might be having with the NRC in our personal lives, is still considered one of the best organizations in the world in terms of public dialogue and debate about whether something is going to work or not.
Thanks, Jeff. We'll go to this man, and please remember to keep your questions brief so that we can get to everybody.
Where we are, in my mind, is where the auto industry was before Henry Ford. Everybody's building a different one, except for the French and the Canadians. Now, if we could just standardize like Henry Ford did, he took over the auto industry for 20 years. We could standardize like the Canadians did and put it all in the same characteristics in a water bath. And we could get away with a lot of things here. And if you want to go for industry, then I think the industries are collecting together to work together, and you don't have to have all that competition.
Just a statement, not a question. We'll go to here. Yep. We'll go to you again. Yep.
Yeah, I just wanted to address about what the gentleman said here about a 1,000-year life on that. My information was it was 10,000-year half-life, if that's not been an issue. No one else brought it up. But that also brings in his point of the shipping of this stuff to the repository all across the country and the hazards of that. If the repository is safe, which hasn't really been proved yet either, that the shipping of it is just a big of hazard, and that the French recycling, I don't know if anyone has heard of the cancer rate around this recycling facility.
Are you asking about the half-life of...
Yeah, well, that could be one question he brought up and no one answered, 1,000 years being back to the original uranium. I was understood that it's a half-life of 10,000 years.
So is that? Can somebody clear that up for him?
Half as powerful, 10,000 years from
plutonium acid. Is a very small byproduct of this process, and the half-life of plutonium is 24,000 years.
So it's half as radioactive in 24?
Right. But we're talking about a very small percent of the spent nuclear fuel being plutonium. 17% is not true.
Well, guys, we could spend a lot of
time. The
regulatory standard is that 10,000 years isn't good enough. That's
right.
The law of the land. Jeff made some fun of that. I think the right metaphor for it is the stuff will remain dangerous beyond the predicted lifetime of any plausible container.
Yes.
And therefore, the objective of regulation is to ensure that there really is geologic protection at geologic scales of time, because the stuff is dangerous for
as well as the shipping, which is today, if it starts with
the proposal. The political problem associated with the issues you are raising has so far prevented the development of a long-term waste disposal solution.
Thanks. Okay, we're going to move on.
Thank you very much for the question. If you go back to the transportation, we do have to have very stringent transportation requirements. We ship nuclear material, both militarily and commercially, around the world, certainly around our country. Some 3,000 shipments have taken place safely and securely.
Okay, we're going to go to this man right here.
One of you mentioned that there's a reactor of 1,600 megawatts that can power Seattle. So if you have that in solar panels, how big of an area? Like a football field? The size of an island?
Sure. No, that's a good question. I'll tell you the rule of thumb I use in California is that if you'll give me 10 miles by 10 miles, which is roughly the land footprint of the Edwards Air Force Base, I can get you 10,000 megawatts of big solar.
Now, and how much of the energy needs would that meet?
In terms of 10,000 megawatts on a 10-mile by 10-mile square foot. That is the California Energy Commission's basic rule of thumb on solar. Now, that is the compact Mitsubishi reactor is 1,600 megawatts, so that's a lot more solar. The difference is the solar gets added in modules of a few tens of kilowatts each that are installed in a year or less in each module. So it is a much more forgiving resource in terms of its scale and rollout than the nuclear plant, where you've got everything on one shaft. And having 1,600 megawatts on one shaft, again, I think that was the lesson of Three Mile Island. There may not have been off-site radioactive consequences, but there were very profound off-site financial consequences.
And also, you mentioned there's 104 units operating. Does that include any of the Navy nuclear reactors?
No.
Really,
that's just commercial. They're about 103 naval reactors.
Okay, we're going to go to this man right here.
Thank you. Given the pitched battle in Nevada over storage, I would like to hear more about the waste which is held on site at the power plants. I mean, what are the political, scientific, and economic hurdles to turning that waste into renewable energy? I mean, why are we locking it up in a mountain if it's a source of energy?
Good question.
Well, from a standpoint of the reprocessing or recycling, we looked at that in this country, and as Ralph said, France is doing reprocessing. They started that many years ago. Japan is completing a reprocessing facility, and the Brits have done some, and the Russians are. It's an economic issue, quite frankly, and it is one that today, from a proliferation standpoint, we would prefer to do a different process than to separate plutonium and make it into MOX fuel as opposed to, because of the proliferation issues. It is truly an economic issue. When we first looked at reprocessing, we didn't know how much uranium resources we would have in this world. And we have now and found quite a large number of uranium resources in countries that are friendly to us, in Canada and Australia. And so we do have a good supply of uranium. But if you look at over the long term, there may be a reason that we want to use nuclear energy for the next 50 to 100 to 150 years. And then that's the case, we may want to have then the technologies to separate out this material, develop those technologies to do it in a way that's not a proliferation concern, and at the same time you're reducing your waste volume.
But it creates a big mess. And I grew up next to the mess that was created by separating out the plutonium from the uranium for making nuclear weapons. It's a very complex process, and even more complex is when you recycle. Every time you recycle, the isotopic composition changes. And so it's not straightforward at this time, the economics of recycling.
So I can sum up by saying it's super expensive to recycle right now. And if you do recycle it, then it's easier to use it for weapons. Is that right?
Okay. It can be.
Let's go over here. Questions only, please, remember.
Jeffrey, you mentioned that one of the advantages to nuclear power is that the cost and availability of the fuel is less uncertain compared to coal and natural gas. I'm aware that in the Arctic we have tons of natural gas that we burn off because it's too expensive to transport. I wonder if the capital investment of a natural gas pipeline would solve the concern about availability and cost of natural gas, and would that capital investment be on the same par as the $8 billion investment in a nuclear power plant?
I have to do some research on that, but they've been trying to build a pipeline across Alaska and another pipeline across Alaska, and I think some people have been indicted for it. But it's an awfully long ways to bring down that gas through Canada. And so the question is more in terms of, will the liquefied natural gas market take off? Now, if the liquefied natural gas market, which is you take gas from someplace where it's cheap, you freeze it, you put it into a ship, and you take it to another part of the world, that might be the way to go. And, you know, with climate change, we might have a nice sea lane to get those LNG ships in and out of the Arctic.
That sounds high carbon footprint to me, Jeff, that idea.
Yeah, right. But, you know, I'm just saying it's an alternative to a big pipeline.
Ralph, do you have anything to add to that?
My very brief addition is that I actually have – the preferred route would follow the current Alaska pipeline, Alaska Highway. Not a big land use impact. Estimated costs are on the order of, depending on who you believe, $10 to $20 billion, which sounds like a very large number, but it's only two nuclear reactors. It is an option worthy of consideration because the gas locked in Prudhoe Bay is equivalent by some estimates to something like 7 times U.S. annual consumption. In my ideal world, that has to compete with energy efficiency and renewable energy, and I think we've got some lower-cost solutions. But it is one more illustration of a competitive alternative to nuclear that the nuclear proponents will have to deal with.
Let's go to the next question. We have just a few minutes.
Sure. I was just curious. I was wondering what the NRC plans to do with the existing nuclear reactors as they reach their lifespan. I know that there's a lot of work being done in academia to keep these 65 Mustangs on the road, but, you know, surely from a material standpoint, they won't last forever.
No. There's extensive work being done in materials issues. NRC has a license renewal regime that we've been going through to extend the licenses of the existing fleet to 60 years. There's just some initial work being done by NRC and the Department of Energy and Industry in looking at what would need to be looked at if a second round of renewals would go through. We're uncertain at this stage whether we would go forward with that.
Coming up awfully quick, it seems like. So it sounds like NRC may be a little behind in that.
No. The 60-year, we're just coming up to the first few would hit 40 in the next 2009, 2010, 2012. So we still then would have the 20 years of that. So
let's take the next question. Yep.
Yeah, thanks. I feel like we've been assured that the playing field has been leveled, and soon enough with all the public outcry about this energy crisis, that renewables and some of these things we're excited about will really have their chance to dig in. But I'm wondering about policy-wise, is it all for naught if the vested interests and all the fossil fuel energy sources continue to tell us that drilling now is really going to get us out of this? And is it really true that some of these things we're excited about have the chance to really take off, whether it be nuclear or whether it be hopefully renewables?
Carbon. That's what we need. If everybody would write a letter complaining about how much carbon there is to Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, and let's get this group organized here. That's the only way anything's going to happen is if we have a carbon policy.
And a spectrum that spans the Nuclear Energy Institute to NRDC agrees with him.
Right.
Which is why I am optimistic that we will, and that is part of what we need to do, even as we need to make sure we have truly competitive resource procurement by our utilities. But here's the good news again, guys. This isn't something that gets decided by federal politicians. It really isn't. And if you want a preview of how it's likely to go, look at what utilities in places like California and Oregon and Washington are buying. buying now and have been buying for the last 30 years. You'll be encouraged.
Let's go to one more.
Mr. Kavanaugh, you were saying that the worry of proliferation abroad is one of the reasons we shouldn't be building plants here. And I wasn't sure if I followed the logic.
Yes, and I think it's a good question. And so we've already got nuclear weapons. What conceivable difference does it make whether we build more reactors in the U.S.? It's precisely because I think Angie's right. We really do have an international leadership role. People look to us for guidance on technology issues. If the message from the U.S. is that nuclear power is part of what it takes to have a robust modern economy, people pay attention. And if the United States is aggressively supporting an international regime for commerce in nuclear fuel, nuclear technology, nuclear engineers, yeah, I think it has an impact.
Let's give a big hand to our panelists for their thoughts here tonight. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you very much.